All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I have been preparing for this show since 4:30 this morning. So if I start to sound crazy, that's why. Okay? I'm not usually up. I'm usually going to bed at 4:30 in the morning, not getting up. Okay? Anyway, this show is a packed show, and it deserves to be. It needs to be. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Ahilan Arulanantham, Director of Advocacy and Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California and a former senior staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. And we're going to be talking about Trump's attack on immigrants. Before that, we'll be talking with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books New York City and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism, on the consolidation of the Trump-Pence regime and what that means for humanity and whether people can still drive it out and what people need to do. And opening the show up, I'm going to read you something here, all right? And this has to do with what Trump just did in relation to what they call the Mexico City policy, okay? Trump, or we shall, why don't we just call him the Fuhrer? The Fuhrer has reinstituted a ban on providing federal money to international groups that perform abortions or provide information about abortions. The regulation known as the Mexico City policy, or by critics as the global gag rule, has been a political volleyball instituted by Republican administrations and rescinded by Democratic ones since 1984. Trump signed an executive action to reinstate a ban one day after the 44th anniversary of the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in the United States. And it's the date on which presidents traditionally take action on the policy. And it also prohibits taxpayer funding for groups that lobby to legalize abortion or to promote it as family planning method. With this action, the Fuhrer has turned his anti-woman rhetoric into policy and made it more difficult for women and families all over the world to access vital reproductive care. So says NARAL President Elisa Hoag. And she adds, he is really living up to the lowest of expectations. Now, I wanted to have someone who I really respect come on the show and speak to some of this, what's going on around abortion rights and the assault on women, and in particular in the wake of this recent development with the Mexico City, policy. And I thought, and it took me about a minute to realize who it was I actually wanted, and I really wanted, so he's always in my mind when I start to think about doing a program on abortion and abortion rights and the importance of that being available to women, and that's Dr. Lee Carhart. And Lee is a doctor performing late-term abortions, and he's going to be talking with us about the Trump regime's opening attack on abortion rights and what the fascist president has promised to do, end all abortions for all women. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. We have to have you back a lot more, man, okay? That's what we'll do. Well, let's jump into this. I don't know how much you know or how well-versed you are in what's going on with Trump's assault, one, around Mexico City, but how do you see this in terms of, one, your thoughts on that kind of ban that's going on, this kind of ban of money to be used for any purpose, abortion aid, or even, you know, there's a number of things that actually are prevented as well, that are necessary for women's health, that are prevented as well in relation to this. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, we're talking about worldwide right now, and if we're not talking about the United States, but, you know, unintended pregnancies and actually the strive for women to maintain their control of fertility is probably one of the leading causes of death in most of the third world countries. I think the estimates are 375 women a day right now in third world countries die from self-attempted or illegal abortions. Or actually, they're not even illegal. They're just done by people that have no idea about medical basis. And to restrict, you know, we were just making great inroads. And it's not only abortion, of course. This also bans people that discuss contraception. So it just opens the women of foreign countries back up to being in a totally controlled environment.
One of the things I read, too, is that, which kind of I think stuns some people, too, is it speaks to abortion. It also speaks to sterilization, which actually is crucial for a lot of women in the world today.
It's actually, I think, barbaric to take these things away from women. It's just it's unreal what it really does to the scope and the depth to which they try to control women's lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that Trump supports a ban, you know, similarly, actually, he talks about he would support a ban on abortion in the U.S. And I wanted to get, you know, give people a sense of both what it means, you know, when you said that this threatens people's lives in the third world, and also what they would do here is also a threat to people's lives, to women's lives. I mean, this is there's a place where this all joins together, and that is women's lives are being put at threat. So let's talk about that a little.
In the United States, even now, I mean, 20-some states have bans after the 20th week of pregnancy due to the protection of the unborn child or pain, fetal pain bill. Nebraska was one of where I practiced mainly, or where my home practice is in Nebraska. They were the first state to propose and pass this law to become legislation. I personally don't think it was or is constitutional now, but it's just we had to pick our fights, and I've been to the Supreme Court twice. I don't necessarily think that it's right for me to be the third person to go back again. But it's now in 25 states, and they're trying to, of course, now make this a national ban. And also then the bill just introduced or announced that will be introduced is to ban abortions after you see fetal heart tones, which is usually by the eighth week. And it's usually before most women even have a clue that they are pregnant. That's what we're worried about right now.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking right now with Dr. Lee Carhart, an abortion provider, a late-term abortion provider, one of only four in the country. And we're talking about Trump, the global gag rule, and the continuing struggle to protect the right to abortion, which, by the way, is a basic human right. You know, one thing Trump has said that he supports the ban on abortion in the U.S. is, and I kept thinking about, I remember interviewing you once, and you and, you know, there's been a number of abortion providers I've spoken with, and actually even when you were, I should tell people, you were in the, I can't remember the name of the film, but you were in a what is the name of the film that was?
After Tiller, the documentary.
After Tiller, yeah, and had very special meaning for you. In terms of Dr. Tiller and your relationship with Dr. Tiller, but also in terms of what it put forward to people about the importance of providers like yourself, which is, it's extremely important, but you are in the sort of the crosshairs of this, what is beginning to happen and is going to happen in terms of what Trump says he's going to support. You told me once that one of the things that really moved you is when you thought about what it actually means in terms of women's lives that they don't have the right to an abortion. Can we talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, I mean, statistically, in I believe the last year or so, well, data is not available before 2014, but the last year the data is available, maybe 2013 that's been published, 2013, 2014. The death rate from abortions of all gestations is about 8 to 10 women per million, okay? The last reported death rate from pregnancy is 14 women per 100,000, or 140 women per million. So just on the basis, if a woman doesn't want to be pregnant, forcing her to remain pregnant is subjecting her to 140 times the death rate, or at least 14 to 100 times the death rate, depending on what the gestation of the abortion is done at. Because most of the problems occur later in the term. And to me, that's cruel and unusual punishment to start with, to force a woman to be pregnant when she doesn't want to, because it is an unnecessary risk of life that she's taking. That's my first thing that bothers me. The second thing, that the males in this country and in most other countries, their right to abort the fetus is from day one. If they don't like a pregnancy, they walk away from it. It's gone. It's none of their business. And good luck if you can find them to force them to pay child care. That doesn't kind of happen. So, to me, it's also a women's equality issue that it should not be left up to the woman whether or not an unplanned conception is what she wants to continue. So those are my two basic fears. And then there are pregnancies, of course, that are harmful to the woman's life and place her at a great risk. And those become even more important to take care of, and especially the third thing, when you have pregnancies that are severely flawed or fatally flawed even, that it just subjects the mother to, if she doesn't want to carry to term, just added on months of agony. So, it's just a multifaceted issue that should really be left to doctors and the patients and nobody else.
Mm-hmm. Now, Trump's talked about if abortion is banned in the U.S., women who have one should be punished. And then he changed that a little to say that, well, actually, we'll say that the abortion providers should be punished. Let's talk about that.
Well, before Roe versus Wade, there were doctors and midwives and lay people that were punished for performing abortions on women in the United States. But we go up north to Canada with Henry Morgenthaler, spent many years in jail because he fought for women's rights before the Canadian laws were reversed to be actually better than ours are now. It probably will mean that the women have to go to the back alleys again and find unlicensed doctors, or not even, you know, nurses or just lay people to do their abortions. We know for a fact that abortions after Roe was made available did not increase in the country. The number remained about the same. And with abortion availability and better education with birth control and other emergency contraception, you know, we've reduced the rate of abortions to the lowest that it's been in ever right now. So unintended pregnancies in teens are way, way down because of the education and the birth control. But we have to go back to the other policy that Trump is also, they've expressed that they're totally against birth control. I mean, abortion they're going for now, but their goal is family planning, period.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was thinking about as you were speaking, there's a point here that when they talked about abortion providers being punished, I couldn't help but think of the number of abortion providers who have been attacked in recent years, and then in particular going back to Dr. Tiller, and who was a personal friend of yours and actually was involved in your, as you began to come into doing abortions, providing abortions for women, you became close friends with him.
I was an associate in this practice for almost from 1997 till 2009, so going on 12 years.
Mm-hmm. And the threat to you and other providers, and the threat that was carried out against him, also points to the threat to you and other providers from these forces. I mean, look, there's a lot of these Yahoo men out there following in the foot tracks of Trump and everybody else and all the stuff that's being built up around this, where, you know, somebody made the point that it kind of struck them that when they were signing the paperwork for the Mexico City thing, that there was all these guys standing around a table writing it into law, this thing, you know, resurrecting this law. And I kept thinking that when they talk about punishing doctors, I mean, there have been doing what you do, Lee, is not a healthy profession in one sense. You know, it's healthy mentally, and what you're doing for people, it's very good. But on the other hand, you got to be careful walking down the street at night.
Exactly. I mean, everything we do is security first. And with Dr. Tiller, he did everything possible to be secure. You know, he had bulletproof automobiles and offices and everything, but his one weakness was that he went to church every Sunday, and of course he was actually murdered in church because that was the least secure place that the assassin could get to. So, it makes it so your life is constantly, well, security is more important than anything else. And, you know, it's already a punishment to be doing abortions because of that. And they, of course, in the last 5 years, the antis have attacked the schools where my landlord's kids went to school in middle school, 10th, 7th graders, that they actually go and protest the children there and with signs that their father is a Nazi and their father is a murderer. Because he rents space, he leases space to me. So, I mean, it's to everybody that actually helps us practice. It's not just to the practitioners themselves.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking right now with Dr. Lee Carhart, an abortion provider, a late-term abortion provider, one of only four in the country. And we're talking about Trump, the global gag rule, and the continuing struggle to protect the right to abortion, which, by the way, is a basic human right. You know, it's kind of, there's something really heavy about referring to other people as murderers and all this other stuff when you look at what these people have done in terms of the killings that they've carried out, the attacks on abortion clinics, the attacks on women that have done this. I was going to ask you about this. Is there, in your estimation, is there now since, and I know it's hard to judge since the, you know, just since the beginning of the Trump regime, but over the last few years, has there been a growth in the anti-abortion movement? There's this anti-abortion march that they're talking about.
I haven't seen any really estimates of numbers. I think the one thing that Trump's right about is the numbers don't matter. And the reason I don't think they matter so much in this movement is because the people that are pro-choice have families and businesses, and that's what's their primary objective, where the anti-choice, they'll take off everything just to go demonstrate and be there. So I don't think the number of people that show up is overwhelmingly important. important, but I do expect, to be very honest, I expect a much less attendance today than there was with the rally last Saturday. But that we're going to have to wait and see what the numbers mm-hmm. come out to be. Mm-hmm. But it's the whole thing, and I was listening to this segment just before you, where they're talking about impeaching Trump. And that's a good idea. I don't think anything's wrong with that. But the problem is that Pence, as far as abortion rights, is probably worse than Trump is. So, I mean, it's not any benefit to us. It's just that the people, you know, we need to wake up and take over now and not wait for the next elections.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that Trump has said, and I really totally agree with you about Pence, and a Christian fascist to the bone, you know, and what he does around this is like really, including what he had already done in Indiana in relation to abortion rights. One thing is Trump has said that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, then the issue of abortion rights will go to the states and things will be decided fairly. What do you think about that? What's our experience been there?
I mean, that's certainly a possibility, but I also wouldn't put it past them to try to take away the rights from the states to allow abortions and just say on a federal basis that abortion is not legal after a certain XYZ. That's what Trump's saying today, that this may happen, but what Trump says today, we found out for years, doesn't necessarily mean anything more than what it is today. Tomorrow it's probably something totally different. So I would imagine their immediate goal would be to limit it to the state decision, which will be good for some women, but it's going to be bad for right now. I'm practicing in Maryland also because that's the state that has the best laws, but now women from all over the eastern half of the United States that are further along in their pregnancies end up coming to Maryland. So It's bad for women in general, I mean, to have to make this trip or to restrict it to states makes it totally unjust for some women.
I couldn't help thinking too about Texas. What happened in Texas immediately as they turned it over to, well, this is a state decision, this is the state draws up all the rules, and immediately abortion clinic after abortion clinic closed down and women were forced to travel hundreds of miles and you know, give up days of work, it became impossible, literally impossible, for many women to actually be able to go and have an abortion. And you think about what that promotes in terms of the self-inflicted abortions or whatever, the self.
Right, absolutely. You know, in Nebraska, where I live and practice right now, there's already a law on the book that says, you know, abortion is illegal in the state of Nebraska, but we have to allow it due to the federal laws. However, if Roe versus Wade decision is reversed, abortions become illegal in Nebraska, effective that day of a reversal. I mean, that is already passed and on our books in Nebraska. So,
Lee, we have one more question, and we do have to have you back, man. Have you back and dig into this a little bit more deeply in the future. But let's talk about this. You inspire a lot of people when you talk about why you're doing abortion. Let's talk about that.
Well, why I'm doing them right now, and to be honest, I'm 75 years old, and I want to slow down. I'm currently working 13 out of 14 days in two different states. I do it for the reasons I stated before, that I think women deserve the right to determine when and if they want to become a parent. And I just giving that equality to women, I think, is so important. And I'm working in the two states where I can do that right now. That when I went to medical school, abortion was illegal, and I was in general surgery residency. And we saw in the emergency room almost weekly women that were coming in and dying. And I have said before that in the hospitals I worked at in Philadelphia in the 69 to 75 era, we had more women die in a week in Philadelphia from abortions that were performed poorly. And granted, some of them were back alley. Most of them were self-attempted or friends taking care of friends. But we saw more women dying a week in one city than we see dying in a year from abortions today when it's legal. And making them illegal again is not going to reduce the number of abortions done. That's been proven over and over in many societies. It's just going to produce the quality of the abortions and control what the actual risk to the woman is besides abortion. And for many, many women, it seems really unusual, but to them, dying is a better option than carrying the pregnancy another day. So you can say that it's the women's fault because they take the risk, but it's, you know, the risk is there. It's part of their makeup. It's part of their choice, and they will take the risk if having this child is not in their best interest. So by taking it away, we're really, really risking the lives of many, many women.
Mm-hmm. And as you once said when I interviewed you before, if not you, who? You know, and that's the it's very important.
I think that, you know, what we'll see if they overturn abortions is, unfortunately, we'll have another war where 50,000 people die. This time it's going to be a war against women, and it's going to be young women that die, not the men in Vietnam, not the men in the East Asia.
That's very, very important. And on that note, Lee, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Talk to you again soon, man.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Dr. Lee Carhart. He's a doctor performing late-term abortions, and we've been talking about the Trump regime's, actually the Fuhrer, his opening attack on abortion rights and what the fascist president has promised to do, and that is end all abortions for all women. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
We're told that after the war, the Nazis vanished without a trace, but battalions of fascists still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45. But they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. They say the prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Whilst Hess remained in prison, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialise. So why did they all come out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
All right, welcome back. That was a song I never get tired of hearing. And I hope you never get tired of hearing it as well. It's The Day the Nazi Died from Chumbawamba. Just a few hours ago, I had the opportunity to speak with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. And we were talking about the consolidation of the Trump-Pence regime and what it means for humanity and whether people can still drive it out. So we're going to take a listen to that call, or to that interview that we did just a couple of hours ago. So check this out. All right. It's a week since the inauguration of Trump, and the fascist is sitting in the White House. He's in power, and there's a whole lot of people wondering what the hell is going on, what are we going to do, what's the situation. And joining us today to talk about this is Andy Z. Andy is a spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and he is one of the three people who really initially initiated the RefuseFascism.org and the whole movement that grew up around that over the last few weeks. And he's here to talk with us about where are we at now. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this because I want to get as much out of it as we can in the time we have. You know, we've talked about a long time ago, well, at the end of last year, when this first became a big question, the point of actually standing up against Trump, recognizing it as him as a fascist and what would be happening if he did come to power. Now the situation has changed. Trump has, to this point, been able to consolidate his, at least stepping into the presidency. Let's talk about that in terms of the, first off, what does it mean for the character of the society right now?
Well, the fact is that he and his regime, with Trump-Pence regime, have power, and that means they have the full force of the state behind them. They're able to, directly through executive order, implement policy. They've got a Congress that's, if not completely intimidated, pretty close to it. And, you know, it's clear that the Democrats, who some are calling Vichy Democrats, reminiscent of the former people in power in France, under occupied France, when it was occupied by the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s, are going to collapse. And this depresses is not completely, but largely intimidated. So he's got power. He's got the authority of the state, and he's moving ahead. He's been throwing a lot of red meat to his fascist social base. And so we're in a very different situation where the Trump-Pence regime has its hands on the reins of power, which means most fundamentally their hands on the ability to repress dissent and to limit speech, and both of which they're moving on in terms of things they're threatening to do and some things they've actually done, including putting extremely heavy charges against protesters, including journalists, for the protests in Washington, D.C.
You know, when you look at some of the other programs that he's actually beginning, I mean, the first couple of days when he actually came out with all of his things around immigrants and the various other things that he's been talking about doing, including the Mexico City abortion, you know, move that he made, that really sort of indicating that he's actually, what has been said by refusefascism.org all along has been that, look, if this guy comes in, there are going to be these series of blatantly fascistic moves that he's going to be implementing from the beginning and from the get-go, and he's going to be trying to steamroller it over the entire society. It seems to be that's the direction that things are heading in pretty rapidly.
Yeah, that's true. And yet from the beginning, Refuse Fascism said that this is going to be more than the sum of all these reactionary measures. And some of this you can see in terms of the tone and the morality and the ideology that's going to dominate society and that he's going to ram through. Everything from the matter of, he talks about and Kellyanne Conway, we talk about an alternative set of facts. Now, this is, you know, on one hand, it's a joke, people laugh at it, but what's really saying is that what we are going to accept as true is what we are going to say and do from the position of power. And you can even watch in Spicer's second press conference how the press began to a large extent, accept those terms. Yes, there was some pushback on some questions, but there is not a unified approach by the press to say, to ask the same question over and over again and to walk out should he continue with this. But there's a method to this madness. You see, this is very similar to what every fascist has done. It's what they say is what is. This goes along with the alternative universe that a lot of his social base has been living in. So this is an extremely dangerous thing. The morality, and even this question of the rule of law. Look, you know I'm the spokesperson for Revolution Books, and as far as I am personally concerned, and the new synthesis of communism that lies developed by Avakian is at the core of Revolution Book, you know, we believe that we live under a society that is constantly and consistently a dictatorship by the class that rules the imperialist class. But what is being instituted here is a whole other form of that rule, which is extremely dangerous. So this is something that needs to be really understood from the beginning. If you look at the inaugural address, just to take one point, almost all the time when presidents run, they speak about, in their inaugural address, upholding the Constitution and the rule of law. If you listen closely to, and even not that closely, to Trump's inaugural, he speaks of the rule of the people, which in translated into the German of Hitler is der Volk, and that the allegiance now is to the people and the movement that he built that is going to express itself through him. This is a different dynamic, which taken to its logical conclusion, including the fact that he has power, means a different way that the society is going to be ruled, even as it continues to be in the interests of the capitalist and the imperialist class. So this is a very big difference. And it really matters. It has everything to do with the kinds of resistance and the kinds of openings that exist in society for dissent, for resistance, for a rebellion, and even for revolution. All of this is of extreme import. So it's not just a matter of a succession of policies, as bad as they are, but it's a synthesis of those policies into a qualitatively different form of what we would call bourgeois rule.
Mm-hmm. See, I think that's extremely important for people to understand. And it makes me think about this, too, because I know a lot of people were saying, look, you know, is it really possible to do what refusefascism.org had said was necessary and what people had set out to do, which was, in fact, to stop this, basically. And, you know, right now it's people are facing this new situation where this guy has come in and he's consolidated his power and all this other stuff. And the question of, is it possible to stop it now? Is it possible? What do we do in the face of this? And people, I think, would look to that, both what happened in terms of the initial effort to prevent him from coming into power, and then second, is it possible to, what's it mean for today?
Yeah, well, that's the big question people need to get into, because we have to stop this. So on the first question of, yes, it was possible, it didn't happen. So that's something that we need to get into very deeply. In the space of 1 month, we accomplished a great deal, including, you know, just for one thing of putting that term fascism and defining it in front of millions of people. Full page ad, New York Times, full page ad, Washington Post, spokespeople on everything from allhiphop.com to Young Turks to those two newspapers, Fox TV, I understand Rachel Maddow did a whole thing the other night, or a little video thing of the no, which is a symbol that was developed by refused fascism and became very, it was all over the place through this movement. So that's just one of the things in terms of setting a different direction. But we had contended at that time that you could only stop something like this by a massive outpouring of millions of people who were refusing to leave the streets, to put it that way, and who were fighting in a certain sense, and I don't mean necessarily fighting, but even if they're out in vigils, but continually and outside the bounds of saying this is unacceptable. This is a very new thing for people in this country, and people did not do that. Yet, on the other hand, the outrage is widespread, and as we saw in the marches, the Women's March, the day after the inaugural, that there was literally, I think, 3.4 million people out in the streets of this country. So there is the widespread disgust and hatred and desire for this to change. So that was, one, the sea of people that we were trying to mobilize into a form of protest prior to the inaugural and more sustained. We were not able to do that in that period of time, and people were not ready for that. And now the task in front of us is to see how that could be mobilized again on a more sustained basis. And there's where there are differences in program going forward. So if you want to get into then how we could do it going forward, we could talk a little bit about that.
All right, let me take a minute to remind listeners that we're talking with Andy Z, the spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and one of the original initiators of refusefascism.org. Yeah, I do. I want to get into the differences of program that you were just talking about. I think it's actually important. How do we actually do this? Because I think that is a big question people are looking at. It's like, okay, we put into this. There's a new juncture. There's a new situation we're in. How are we actually going to do this now? How do we do this going forward?
Well, okay. So for all those who were following Refused Fascism or checking it out, and for those who threw their heart and soul into it for the last month, I think one of the first things you have to do is, and that we all have to do collectively over the next couple of weeks, is take stock of what we actually did do, what we said, what we accomplished, and then really try to take a close look at what resonated, what didn't, why didn't it resonate, and come to a summation of this last period that would enable us to understand what we did do and where either we fell short through errors or where people themselves didn't themselves yet understand the nature of what they were up against. So this is still remains something that has to, a process that has to go on. That's number one. And, you know, you have to analyze this. There's a lot of people who are out in the streets who say we have to prepare grassroots organizing like the Tea Party to take the Congress back. Well, is that going to work? How does that mobilize people? How does that demobilize people? And in fact, if you really come to grips with it's a fascist regime, I think it would evidence that that's foolish at best, because why do you think he's making all this fuss about the illegal voting, which is clearly a fabrication of his, because he wants to further restrict voting rights, further rewrite districting, further restrict access, so that they do lock in a majority, because fascists will always prefer to come to power and to exercise their rule through what would be seen as legitimate ways while changing the actual mechanisms of what I would call bourgeois, and we would call bourgeois democracy. Now, Refused Fascism, you know, is an organization that involves many people who believe very deeply in the system and want to return it to that. That's a very important point, and it's a broad coalition in that sense. But the second point is, including right now, we have to keep our eyes peeled for developments that could actually bring out millions of people in a more sustained way, because the rage and outrage and the reality of what's happening is beginning to dawn on people. So I don't want to get too much into specific scenarios, but you could have a situation where he does take a measure just one step too far. There could be an attack on a section of people that strikes the outrage of people. I mean, just think of some of the things that happened in the Black Lives Matter movement, or that sparked that movement. Trayvon Martin, who would have thought? Just one kid down south, nobody ever heard of him, a small Florida town, and then a nationwide movement grows up around that. I think in this situation, things like that could happen that encourage people to not just come out in their millions in one day of protest, but to say, now's the time, we have to stop it. So people in Refuse of Fascism, as well as people much more broadly, need to be attuned to those kinds of developments where what we were aiming for before this could become possible. And the sooner the better, because they are going to cement into place some pretty repressive stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, including, just might take one more moment here, he's already threatened to bring the feds, as he put it, into Chicago. Well, who is that going to be aimed at? It's going to be aimed at the people who suffer the most under this system, in part because that's people that he and people like him fear the most.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really important point, I think. I mean, I was thinking about this point that you've raised in the letter that you, Carl, and Sansara wrote, and this point of the point that is made about this new juncture, and that the fact that there is, you know, look, the normal workings of the system is one thing, but when you have this in terms of a fascist in power, the possibility of crisis is something people have to be keenly attuned to, and actually understand what doors might open or might not open in relation to this, but really understanding that the juncture here and where they need to go now, where things need to go now, and what are the consequences of not, what are the consequences of actually missing that? There's sort of consequences that humanity should not have to face, okay?
Yeah, you're right. This is, he's doing things now that threaten the future of humanity. On climate, he's totally rewriting the book on international relations. He says, you know, he's going by the, he's advocating war crimes, and they're actually instituting measures, potentially, apparently, reauthorizing black sites and torture. And let alone, you have to remember, he has his hand on the nuclear codes and has actually speculated about why don't we use these weapons. So this is an extremely dangerous situation, but in its danger, in the extremeness of the situation, also lies the potential for millions of people to act. But there will be a necessity to try and act soon, and we're going to have to develop the ways to do that, including, there's some very positive protests around immigration the last two nights in New York and L.A. and different cities around the country. I think some stuff in the Southwest, Denver, and places like that. So this is a very positive development. I think refused fascism itself will have to regroup and itself call for things. But the most important thing is to be prepared, especially now, for sudden changes in the situation and to be able to seize on them, to be able to, at this point, we're going to have to drive our regime out. And that was, I think, one of the sticking points for people of, well, how do you do that? He was elected, and people are going to have to take another look at, you know, as we said in the call for refused fascism, no election, whether fair or fraudulent, should legitimate a regime that is illegitimate because of what it stands for and what it will do. And now we can add what it is actually doing.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy Z, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll have you back, man. We've got to follow this continuously, man, because it's not something that can be just sort of spoken to in a minute and dropped. So definitely come back, all right?
Okay, you're doing good work, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye. That was Andy Z, the spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. We're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk about what the hell is going on with the immigrants' right issue and Trump, all right? So check this out.
Smash the system.
Let's go down to the riot, it's summertime. And now's the time to smash the system.
Smash the system.
Smash the system.
Smash the system.
We got the numbers, roll up a number. Let's have an adventure on the escalator.
All right, I confess. I just had to get that in here, all right? And I would play it much longer, but we don't have that much time. And so I want to jump into this because my next guest, I've been really looking forward to talking with him. His name is Ahilan Arulanantham, and he's the Director of Advocacy, Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California, and a former senior staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrant Rights Project. Ahilan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's jump into this, man. One of the central themes of Trump's whole program is his clampdown on immigrant people, and he's repeatedly ranted about how central this crackdown is on what he calls illegal immigrants, and it's all part of his Make America Great. Well, just recently, one of the big things he did was he put up what he's planning to do about this. What's your take on the overall assault as it rolled out this week?
I think what he did this week with the two executive orders on immigration is very consistent with what the campaign rhetoric was. But I think what's so striking is that it's an attempt to enact sort of all the worst, most draconian immigration enforcement policies all at once. And I think the scale of and the ambition of the crackdown that is envisioned in those orders is really striking. You know, even if you heard all of the statements and believed all the statements that he, you know, the racist statements and blatantly anti-immigrant statements that he made in the campaign, I still think it's just surprising to see the whole thing manifested so clearly in two documents, and apparently more to come, but at least in those two documents.
Yeah, it's surprising and it's bone-chilling as well. And when you think about this, I mean, this is the cat who is sitting up there, and he's controlling the largest, most powerful imperial country to ever exist in the world. And he's taking aim at all the things that actually are things that people are doing for survival. And he's basically taking aim, like in relation to this, at a whole people who simply are doing what they need to do to survive. And he talks about he's fixing what's gone wrong. To me, it's just that, you know, people have to recognize what this is. It's an assault against a whole section of people that have been deemed criminal by him.
Yeah, I think it's an assault on families. It is, because so many of the people who are targeted by this set of orders, and they, you want to say, oh, these are criminals. That's the sort of rhetoric used in the order. But aside from the fact that, you know, that category is very broad and it's often used to refer to people. I mean, the order attempts to refer to anybody who's arrested, basically, can fall into that category. You know, but you can't escape the fact that we're talking about people who are living in families with parents and children and siblings who, in many cases, have lived in this country for decades. Many of the people targeted by this order are living here lawfully under the immigration laws. They have green cards. And as you say, many of the other people, whether they're, you know, it's lawful under the existing immigration law or not, they've lived here for decades. And the majority, vast majority of the American public actually recognizes that there needs to be some rational way of legalizing those people over time. But this is not an administration which is acting consistent with what the majority of people think on the subject. They really are on the extreme fringe when it comes to immigration policy, and a lot of other things too, I think, but certainly when it comes to immigration policy, they're on the extreme fringe and they're really enacting the far right anti-immigrant agenda on that set of issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at a couple of these things. There's the one, a couple of the directives so far. The one is border security and immigration enforcement improvements and interior immigration enforcement. Let's look at the border security and immigration enforcement improvements first. What's that actually mean in the world today?
Well, there's a number of things in that order and also in the other one. And I think in some ways it makes sense to think about them as a kind of coherent whole. But I think the three core things that these are doing, the first one, the border one, the number one thing it's doing more than anything else is it's trying to massively expand the number of people who are detained in the immigration detention system. And that's a system that already massively expanded under President Obama. So it's actually well over 40,000 people every day. We're talking about small cities worth of people are living in these immigration detention centers. These are all people who are not there for any kind of crime. The vast majority of them actually now have not been convicted of a crime. But even those that have been convicted of a crime they finished serving their sentence, but now are then separately arrested by immigration and put there. And he wants to massively increase the size of that. He wants to build new detention centers, send the judges to the detention centers so that you can sort of run the whole thing, the whole court process, immigration court process out of the detention centers. So that's one very large aspect of it. Another large aspect, which is also in the first one, the border enforcement executive order, is to try to find ways to deport people without giving them hearings in front of judges. So there are a couple of different provisions there which are really aimed at trying to short-circuit the immigration judge and immigration court process as a whole and find them, they say, you know, consistent with law, the maximum possible way, consistent with law, to kick people out of the country without even giving them a day in court. So that's another thing that it does. And then I think the third thing that I would say out of that order, which is very important, is there are a number of steps taken that are targeted specifically at asylum seekers. This is people who are coming to the border, fleeing often the most violent countries in the world, like the Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, but also people coming from all over the globe, coming to the border and asking for asylum. And, you know, just like people did in Jewish people did in World War II, which is what really created, led to the creation of the Refugee Convention. You know, that same act of coming to the border, whether by boat or by land, and asking for protection. And this order tries to basically, it did a number of things. One thing it tries to do is turn them back, let them stay outside the U.S. while we take our time in deciding whether they're asylum case. Another thing it does is it tries to detain them. So lock them all up. Now some of them get locked up and others of them get released, and it wants to try and increase that to lock them basically all up while their cases are pending. And it also just in a sort of naked way, I think almost it's trying to just deny more of them. You know, try to interpret these the laws more narrowly to deny asylum to more of those people. So those are, I think, the most disturbing parts. This is a stiff competition, you know, there's
yeah,
a
right.
lot of nasty
yeah.
stuff in that order. But I think those are the in my view, the sort of most disturbing parts of the border one. Then I mean, I'm talking to you for a long time.
Well, let me ask you one question real quick before you get into the next thing. It seems to me that related to what you've just been talking about, too, though, is this just amping up of the militarization of the border and the actual border army that's down there now, you know, 5,000
yeah.
border patrol, 10,000 immigration officers. This is a mid-sized army he's got going.
Yes, and if you live in the border region, it is really a fundamentally different experience from living in Los Angeles or in lots of other parts of the country. People already living in southern parts of California, in Tucson, in El Paso, in Las Cruces, New Mexico, there are Border Patrol vans driving around on the regular streets. And in many cases, they pull people over. The traffic stops, like what you would happen to you if you were speeding on, you know, the freeway. Border Patrol pulls people over in regular traffic stops and asks them to about their immigration status. And then they go into people's houses. And there's all kinds of abuses that have been documented for years with the Border Patrol. And instead of taking the lessons from that, which is really threatening the liberty of so many people, including many American citizens who are living in the border region, the lesson that they've taken is, oh, we want to do more of that to chase a phantom, you know, immigration wave, which actually doesn't even exist. So, yeah, that's the border ramp up is another very deeply troubling. You know, like I said, there's a lot of things that are wrong with the executive orders, and that's another one of them.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking right now with Ahilan Arulanatham, the Director of Advocacy, Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California, and a former senior staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. And we're talking about Trump's first moves to attack immigrants. Well, one thing I was wondering about, too, is that, and you've spoken to this somewhat, but, you know, this thing about the Secure Communities Program, this is like, you know, what the hell is he talking? You know, it just makes you, it makes just your blood boil, you know, and your tongue get
right.
stuck on your teeth because he's talking about this. And it's give people a sense of what that actually will mean. I mean, the concretes of it.
Yeah, so that is what I would say in the second memo, the interior memo, although it's referenced in both. The engine, one thing that these orders make clear is the engine for the mass deportation machine that Trump wants to create is not only going to be the things that I mentioned already, the increase in detention and then trying to deport people without hearings. It's also going to involve an attempt to bring entirely into the federal immigration enforcement bureaucracy all the state and local law enforcement officers. In fact, it's a striking thing about the order. The order said it is now the policy of the U.S. federal government to engage in state and local law enforcement cooperation on immigration enforcement. And the Obama administration tried that in a much more limited way compared to what this order contemplates through secure communities and through some other programs as well. And they were disastrous. And what secure communities was a program where basically every time a police officer arrested somebody, their arrest information, like their fingerprints and that kind of information, would be shared with federal immigration officials so that if the person could be put into the deportation process, then immigration would know that and then go out and begin that process. And it's completely disastrous because obviously that discourages people from having contact with law enforcement. Because if you think, for example, in a domestic violence situation, it's very sad, but it's very common. And when that happens, the police will often arrest both people, both, I think, sometimes for cooling off, but also try and sort out, you get competing allegations, right, of who's doing what. Well, under the program, any person who is arrested has their information sent to immigration. So what does that do? It obviously prevents victims of domestic violence who have concerns about their immigration status. And concerns can come for a variety of reasons, right, whether you're lawfully present or not. It deters them from reporting the crime. And that's just one example. It's not just domestic violence, although that's obviously a very serious problem. It's all kinds of crimes will be underreported because victims of the crimes will be scared to report them. And that's actually the reason why there was a revolt, even under the Obama administration, by police chiefs and other state and local law enforcement officials all around the country against secure communities because it was undermining public safety. And again, the Trump administration completely ignoring that history from the last few years, instead wants to double down on this in a huge way and essentially make every law enforcement officer in the country a immigration cop. And that is both, you know, it's a horrible use of resources by police officers, but it is also extremely frightening to people who have any concerns about their immigration status that are driving all around. And in Los Angeles, you've got, you know, a million undocumented people who are part of the fabric of our society. And those people are now going to be under threat if this gets implemented. You know, there's going to be a lot of resistance to this in the state and at the local level. But that's, I think, what the fight over that is coming.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Dreamers? I know this is something that a lot of people have said, wait a minute, all these people who put their faith in this idea of that if they just came forward and turned it, gave, I mean, these people have given everything over, where they live, who they are, whatever ID they have. What about them in relation to this whole thing?
So thus far, there has not been an executive order specifically about Dreamers and people who came forward and got the status that President Obama made available through the DACA program. And there was a floated, what may have been a draft, but you know, it was a leak, and then no one knew if it was a real order or not. And my preference is actually not to speculate about, enough to talk about what the orders that already are there. But, you know, obviously, what I suspect is that there was a massive debate going on within the administration about whether or not to take that even sort of one step further to all what they've done already and actually also specifically go after DACA recipients or Dreamers. Right. And as a result, for whatever reason, that hasn't, nothing on that has come down one way or the other yet.
All right, let me ask you one last question, and we'll have to be a little bit quick on it, but sanctuary cities. There has been a lot of stuff involved coming from Trump about actually attacking sanctuary cities.
Yes. So the Interior Enforcement Order.
And tell people what sanctuary cities are too, okay?
Sanctuary cities are essentially the resistance to what we were just talking about earlier, secure communities and other attempts to get state and local law enforcement officers to be involved in federal immigration enforcement. And essentially a sanctuary city is a city that creates policy preventing its law enforcement officials from participating in this massive immigration crackdown by saying, look, we're going to enforce the laws of public safety. We're not going to enforce the immigration law. We don't share information about immigration status with the federal government. And that's what Los Angeles's policy has been. It's really largely the state of California's policy and a number of other cities and states as well. And one of the things that the order tries to do is see if there are ways. So it doesn't yet do it, but it asks to kind of, it directs the DHS secretary and other officials to try to find a way to punish cities and states that do that financially by trying to figure out if there's a way to take away federal funding for law enforcement and for potentially other things by designating them as cities that are violating or trying to interfere with federal immigration law enforcement. And I think you hear the Republicans and the conservatives in general talk about states' rights. And here you have a situation where the state wants to go one way and the federal government is going to try to prevent that from happening and use all of its power to restrict the state's power to protect its people. And there's going, I suspect there will be a lot of legal fights over that because a lot of people in California think that the federal government cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ahilan, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I still have a bunch of things I want to ask you about what's going on in the Middle East in relation to all this. So we'll have you back soon, okay?
I would love that.
Okay, great, man. All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ahilan Arulanatham, and he's the Director of Advocacy, Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California, and former Senior Staff Attorney at ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Dr. Lee Carhart, Andy Z, and Ahilan Arulanatham. I also like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Kiana Williams. And I want to be sure to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And if you're interested in helping to work on a show, we got 1,001 things that people can help in doing. And so just write to me there and say, hey, I want to do something, and we'll be in touch with you right away. Now, I'm going to cut the show off right now because there's a song here that I want people to get a chance to hear this song, or at least hear as much of it as you can right now, because it's just that powerful. And the song is Immigraniata, We Come in Rougher by Gogo Bordello. Check this out.
Emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada, da, emigrada, emigraniada. We're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher.
We're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey.
We're coming rougher every time.
Emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada.
We're coming. Corridors full of tear gas, our destinies jammed every day, like deleted scenes from Kafka, flush down the bureaucratic drain. But if you give me the invitation to hear the bells of freedom chime, to hell with your double standard, we're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher.
We're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey.
We're coming rougher every time. Quickly jaded, to them we got nothing to say. Our emigrada, emigraniada, for them is Don Quixote's kind of way. But if you give me the invitation to hear the bells of freedom chime, to hell with your double standard, we're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher.
We're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey.
We're coming rougher. Start again from zero. It's a book of true stories, true stories that can be denied. It's more than true, it actually happened. It's more than true, it actually happened. It's more than true, it actually happened. We're coming rubber every time.